Online, on digital, and on 103.5 FM. This is 3MBS Fine Music Melbourne.
Welcome to Reflections. I'm Doug Beecroft. Todd Woodbridge is one of the most successful Australian tennis players of all time. He picked up a tennis racket at 4, played his first tournament at 6, and decided to be a tennis professional when he was 10. The rest is history. He's best known for his partnership with Mark Woodford. The Woodies, as they were known, became Australian icons of the tennis world, breaking all records at the time for the most successful doubles partnership in history by winning 61 career doubles titles, including 6 Wimbledon victories, all the Grand Slams, as well as the Olympic Games gold medal in Atlanta in 1996 and the silver medal at the Sydney Olympics in 2000. In 2010, the Woodies were inducted into the International and Australian Halls of Fame. And in recent years, Todd's been coach of the Australian Davis Cup team, as well as a popular tennis television commentator. Welcome to 3MBS, Todd.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Doug.
That's our very great pleasure. And you must be excited about the recent French Open.
Well, to have a Grand Slam champion from our country is absolutely superb. And Ash Barty did it the way that we'd love to see Australians do it. It harks back to the golden era of Australian tennis when you had the Hodes, the Rosewells, the Lavers, the Courts and the Goolagongs that the world loved. They were competitive, they were hard-natured, but they also had great respect and were respected around the world. And that's what Ash Barty has brought back to our game.
She certainly has. A very wonderful persona. Really,
yeah, a great ambassador. A steely competitor, but lots of composure. She speaks so well. She manages the media. A lot of people talk about talent, with sports people. She has the whole package of talent, whether that be physical, mental, and the skills on the court as well. So we're very proud of her.
Thank you, Todd. And all of those things you said, of course, reflect on you too, which we'll be talking about shortly. But before we go on with talking about you and your life, you've got a very strong interest in musical theatre. And I read that you've gone to the musical theatre whenever you've been in London and New York. It's a bit of a passion.
It is. And it started early for me. My coach was a fellow by the name of Ray Ruffles, a former Davis Cup player for Australia. And we travelled as young kids, young teenagers to Europe. And he would say, all right, well, you're not just going to be tennis players. You're going to try to learn something about the culture of the places that you go to. And so one of those early things was he'd say, well, let's go to the theatre. And, some people say musical theatre isn't culture, but it starts. And that's how it started for me. And so, from my very first musical that I went to see in the UK was Starlight Express in the mid to late 80s. And things grew from there. And so the tennis circuit follows a bit of the musical theatre showcases, doesn't it? Because we go to London for Wimbledon, and then of course we go over to New York,
West End and Broadway.
Yeah, and it doesn't get any bigger than that.
Fabulous. Which leads us on to your first selection of music, which is from Love Never Dies, and it's with the Australian singer Ben Lewis. Why have you chosen this?
Well, my love of theatre passed on to my son Beau, and Beau's now 16, about to turn 17 in July, and I had a great moment of taking him to Billy Elliot. He was around about, I think at that point, 7, 8 years of age. It was the opening night here in Melbourne. And we had some lovely photos together and we had great seats. And he was watching the stage and fixed upon it. And for that moment, he wanted to do something within music. By the age of 9, about 18 months later, he was in his first show. And he played young Gustav in Love Never Dies. And through that association with that show, my family, my wife Natasha, daughter Zara and Beau, we got to become very good friends with Ben Lewis, his wife Mel Stewart. We still catch up with them every year. We're about to do it in a few weeks' time now at Wimbledon. And we cross over between sport and music.
The day starts, the day ends, time crawls by. Night steals in, pacing the floor. The moment thoughts creep, yet I can't bear to sleep till I hear you sing. And weeks pass, and months pass, seasons fly. Still you don't walk through my door. I dream that you are there, but wake, holding nothing but the cold night air. And years come, and years go, time runs dry. Still I ache deep in my core, my broken soul.
Till I Hear You Sing from Love Never Dies by Andrew Lloyd Webber, and Ben Lewis was singing with the original Australian cast. Thanks, Todd Woodbridge, for that selection. Todd, want to talk about you when you were young. If we go back 40 plus years to young Todd, it seems that you had a very different life to many other boys of your age. Can you describe it?
Look, I was, my mother and father called me the mistake. You know, I had two brothers who have since passed away, Greg and Warren, 13 and 11 years older than me. So I came along in an era, my mum was nearly 40 when she had me, and that was unusual at that particular time to come along and have older parents. So I grew up with older people. I was, you know, my brothers were gone really from when I can remember.
They died before you were young.
Well, no, they've both passed away at 58, one right. 2.5 years ago and one in September last year. One expected, and I'll talk about him, that was Greg. And he had a big influence on my life that eventually I got to tell him about, but he didn't really understand. As I was growing up from the ages of 6 through to 10, he was a heroin addict and a severe one. Mm. And my father was a police officer, my mum a hairdresser. But if you can imagine your parents being a police officer, then having to deal with a drug addiction in the house was very tough. And I grew up watching this, but as a young kid, and it became very real to me that I had to do something with my life that was different to that. And I had already had this, you know, I was connected to tennis because of my mum. She played three times a week in local competitions, and I was always at the tennis club, and I hit against the wall, and I knew I had some skills. And I, although I didn't know at the time, I was going to use that as my vehicle to do something with my life. And so I was very driven at a young age because of what I had to watch at home and how it affected the family, and in the end what it did to my brother, because eventually when he did pass away, it was due to all of the damage that he did internally through drugs and contracting things of hepatitis A, B, C, basically everything that he could have had. So it was self-inflicted, his. So that was a real moment in my early career that set me off on tennis.
So many young people who have got an extreme talent like yours have it driven at the start, a prodigious talent, by parents or someone who's actually pushing. That wasn't the case with you. It was coming from you. That's quite unusual.
Yeah, I have a strong personality, a strong drive to succeed, and sometimes that's a blessing, sometimes it's a curse, because you often feel that you're failing when you're still doing quite well, and you drive yourself to, you know, distraction, and it really can be troublesome. I had moments like that early in my career where I felt like I was really failing. But in terms of my tennis, I was lucky, because by the age of 11, 12, I was winning national titles, and I was always the number one player in my age group. And I kept just making that step up the ladder consistently. I really didn't have, you could call it the snakes and ladders of sports and careers, where I fell down and had to get back up. It was always on a nice little arc towards being successful. So that part of my career as a young teenager, you know, I was lucky. But again, that comes from, it came from me. You asked about my parents. They were a great support. They were always there, always acknowledged, and I always said, you don't have to do it if you don't want to. And I always remember that line, because that made it then mine. I'm sure my dad wanted me to, and he really, I suppose, did push me, but he never made me feel that way. And that was great support.
Your life as a young person was very different. I wonder what a day would be like, a school day would be like for you. For most kids, they go to school, go home and muck around with their mates. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you?
Well, I would race home, and I had a tennis court next door to me, and I'd start hitting on the court straight away. And a funny story I do remember about a few of my mates who were experimenting with smoking, both cigarettes and some pot at one point. And they said, come on down to the park. And so I went down the park. I said, well, I'm not having anything to do with that. And I was the guard to make sure that they didn't get caught. I stood 100 metres away.
An important role.
Yeah. But, you know, even at that age, I knew, no thanks, I'm not interested in going down that path. So a lot of my friendships then developed within sport, and people that were more like myself. So, you know, my schooling was a very, very, you'd say difficult, but I knew what I wanted to do. I went to 6 different high schools because of tennis. I changed every year because of different programs to make sure I was getting what I wanted in terms of coaching.
That is focus. In 1986, when you were 17, you saw Pat Cash win the 1986 Davis Cup, and you found it to be an inspiration. What did you feel, and were you thinking, this could be me at that particular point?
Well, that year was the first year that I went to Wimbledon to play junior Wimbledon, and in fact qualified for the mixed doubles. So in my very first Wimbledon, I played a main draw event, and then you watch Pat Cash win it. As he was actually winning his title on the centre court against Ivan Lendl, Jason Stoltenberg and myself were winning the junior boys doubles on court one. So we didn't actually get to watch it live. We could hear the roars everything happening as we were playing our own match. And in those days, the old court one was connected to the centre court. And so the next part to that story was I went back the next year. I qualified for the singles as a 17-year-old. And I said, I don't care who I play. You know, if I could play Pat Cash, that'd be brilliant, because you would play on the centre court. He would open as the champion. And lo and behold, who did I draw? I drew Pat Cash. So my first open main draw singles match was to play against him on the centre court. So he plays a big part in my history at Wimbledon.
Starting at the top. Let's go to your next musical choice. And this is one by Michael Tippett. It's an unusual one, The Unpurged Images of the Day Recede, from a piece called Byzantium. And it's the singer who particularly interests
people,
you.
Look, I must confess that opera is not my thing. And so when we were having this discussion, I thought your listeners would find it a little amusing, if not enjoyable as well. But Faye Robinson is the singer here. And Faye is a friend, befriended because of her love for tennis. So she would travel to the circuit for 10 odd years while we were playing. She'd be in Paris, she'd be at Wimbledon, the US Open. And I knew she was a singer. I didn't know how good and how well respected she was as a singer. And more recently, just a couple of US Opens back, I took Beau, my son, to the US Open, and she met him. And she, at that point, his voice wasn't ready. But she says, as soon as he's ready, which is about now, bring him back and I will help him with his voice. And so I don't think he'd get a much better teacher than Faye Robinson.
Faye Robinson was singing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Schulte, The Unpurged Images of the Day Recede by Michael Tippett. Thanks, Todd Woodbridge, for that choice. Todd, let's go on now to you being a champion. But before we do, I'd just like you to tell our listeners about that school report.
Well, as I mentioned, I went to six different high schools, and the last one was Lake Dinajeric College in Canberra when I was at the Australian Institute of Sport. And I mentioned being at Wimbledon as a teenager. Well, my report card on one particular term for geography, it read, absent 60 days, present 6. And the note read, Todd, been watching your results. Keep up the good work. So that was from
wonderful.
Steve, the teacher.
Well, it was sort of relevant to geography because you were somewhere else. Becoming a tennis champion wasn't all beer and Skittles, and I saw a clip where you said that you picked up a racket when you were four, trained over 40,000 hours, rain or shine, watched 2,000 hours of playback to perfect your volley, endured a dozen sprained ankles, tore muscles, and you endured the pain of losing. Which begs the question, why do it?
Because you get those moments of glory that take you to the top of the mountain where you feel invincible. And sport, unlike many jobs, is, in particularly tennis, you win on one day and you feel you're the best. And then the next day you've got to go back out and do it, and you lose and you feel like you're the pits of the earth. That emotional roller coaster that a professional athlete goes through can make and break you. And you have to learn to be resilient, and you have to learn to turn up the next day and enjoy doing it all again. So those moments are in fact what drives you, you know, looking for that perfection, although you don't get perfection. In my case, it was more looking for that victory, and didn't matter whether you played brilliant or not, getting across the line was that feeling inside of comfort.
So there's a certain amount of psychological control, isn't there, to actually cope with the downtimes when perhaps a match doesn't go the way you want, or a competition doesn't go the way you want or expect.
Very, very much so. I mean, I didn't have a great temperament. People seem to forget that. We talk about some of the Aussie players now. I had my moments on court, but I regretted those moments and learnt to try to cope with them. One of the harder things in tennis is dealing with nerves and stress when you're about to win, actually, and getting nervous and finishing it off. I used to choke a lot. I used to have a dodgy serve, and I'd always lose my serve serving for matches, and it became a psychological thing. And you have to learn to change the way you think. And I used to in the end get better by going out and saying, well, this is a great challenge, let's see whether I can do this, as opposed to saying, oh my goodness, do you think I can win it? And you have to learn to get away from it. So in terms of serving for matches, I had a block where I really did get over it, and as it turned out, it was always me serving for the major in the final in the last game. And between that, I served out a French Open, a Wimbledon, an Olympics, and then an Australian Open all in a row. So that was how ironic that the fella that couldn't do it ended up having to do it.
Yes, indeed. The partnership you had with Mark Woodford was obviously extremely successful, and you were described as the perfect doubles team. What do you think made it perfect?
Well, we were both really good leaders. A lot of people thought that Mark was the more senior, which he was, 5.5 years older than me, that he led the team. He was older, calmer, seemed to be the one that did that. In actual fact, though, when you're calmer, you have days on court that you are flat. And when he was flat, I knew I had to take the lead and get the team up and get us going. And I could be the one that could spark the difference within a match because of my personality on the court. So you gel together, and you can't have the same things. The other part to the technique of our combination was the left and right hand combination. All the great teams across the history have been those, if you think of Newcomb and Roach and McEnroe and Fleming, and the Bryan brothers more recently after us are the same. And so it was the gel between us. And the other part to our success is that we both had the same goal, and we talked about that often.
Communication must be important. How much is intuitive, do you think, in a relationship like that in terms of what you do on court, and how much is a matter of communication between you?
Communication is the beginning of becoming intuitive, and for us that was a key. We would talk a lot about tactics. We were a very tactical team because we didn't have masses of power. We had to work out the weaknesses of our opponents, and I think with Mark and I, we would do a lot of that off court. And then on court, as the years went by, I knew what shot he would play from what part of the court. And so I was already covering into those spaces, and likewise was Mark. So, that was really important. I think, our biggest point of communication came in 99, which is our weakest year. We only won a few smaller events that year. And I actually pulled him aside and said, if we don't start picking our game up, then we're pretty much done. We should quit, because this isn't how we should be playing. Yeah. And from that moment on, we ended up having our best run that we ever had. We won 5 big tournaments in a row, starting in Hamburg, then the French Open, which we hadn't won. That was the last one of our majors that we had to get. We went on and won Queen's Club, Wimbledon, the ATP Championships, And that was, you know, the sort of brilliant end to our career. So that was a real key. That was a key moment of communication that made a difference and made us finish strong.
Is every partnership different? Because you took up later with the Swedish Jonas Björkman.
Mm, very much so. Look, I was very fortunate that when Mark decided to retire after the Olympics in Sydney, that was our very last tournament that we played. I was the number one player in the world, so I had the choice of the locker room. There were people sort of putting their hand up, wanting to play with me. And I chose Jonas Björkman because he was the player I'd least liked playing against, and I preferred to have him on my side. But again, his strengths matched my weaknesses. He was a very vivacious player, very, very aggressive. He was a great mover at net, which I needed. He served big. I loved his attitude. And so there was a different personality for me to move into with him that I needed at that point. I needed somebody like him to push me. And he actually pushed me the last few years of my career, which I really appreciate. In fact, he pushed me out of the game, which is another story, because at the end of 2004, I went to the last tournament of the year in Paris, and he hadn't told me. He said, "I'm sorry, but I've got a new partner next year. We're done." And I really didn't have a partner. And I'm going, wow. But what he did was made me have a look at myself. And at that particular point, I thought, well, you know what? He might be right. I've got a young family, and it's an opportunity for me to start the next phase of my career. So I did play six more months after that, but I finished at Wimbledon in 2005.
Let's continue in a moment. The next piece you've chosen is by Simon Gleeson, a young Australian actor and singer. And why have you chosen this piece?
Well, I've mentioned Bo being in Love Never Dies, and of course, Ben Lewis, who sang Till I Hear You Sing, was the Phantom, and Simon Gleeson played Raoul. They were both Bo's father in that show, and I have a similar relationship ongoing with Simon Gleeson and his wife, Nat. And this was his album that he put out about 18 months ago, and it's a pure album for me. And this piece is, it's called A Bit of Earth. And Simon really resonates in this piece, the way that he sings. It's a great feeling. And I love his album. And I think anybody out there, if you like this piece, go and listen to it. It's called Elements.
A bit of earth. She wants a little bit of earth. She'll plant some seeds. The seeds will grow. The flowers bloom, but is their bounty what she needs? How can she chance to love a little bit of earth? Does she not know? The earth is old and doesn't care if one small girl wants things to grow. She needs a friend. She needs a father, brother, sister, mother's arms. She needs to laugh. She needs to dance and learn to work her girlish charms. She needs a home. The only thing she really needs, I cannot give. Instead, she asks a bit of earth to make it live. Should have a pony gallop across the moor. She should have a doll's house with 100 rooms per floor. Why can't she ask for treasure? Something that money can. Flowers bloom, their beauty just the thing she needs. She'll grow to love the tender roses, lily fair, the iris tall. And then in fall, her bit of earth will freeze
kill them all. A bit of earth, a bit of earth, a bit of earth, a bit of earth.
A Bit of Earth from Elements, sung by Simon Gleeson. This is Reflections on 3MBS, and my guest is Australian tennis champion Todd Woodbridge. Todd, what are the most important qualities to perform at a peak international level in tennis? I think about physical qualities for a start. There are certain basic skills you've just got to have, and some that would be learned.
Well, the game has changed very much over the last 15 to 20 years. When I was coming through, skills were the most important thing. And by skills, I mean the ability to hit half volleys, get to the net, volley well, have a broad repertoire. And serving was big, but serving has become a key element, which I didn't have. And now the game is played more physical from the baseline. It's played laterally, and it has really changed, and that's been a lot to do with the technology of string in particular. The shape of the ball, the trajectory that we see hit in the modern game is very different to the one I hit. I crossed over in those eras, so I can actually hit the ball better in some parts of the court now than I did when I finished 15 years ago. So that's how technology has helped the current player. But what that has done is changed the skill levels of the younger generation. So we talked about Ash Barty briefly at the top of the show. Her skill level matches the eras of time gone by, but she's a modern player to go with it, which is why she's being so successful. But I think the key to a player, whether it be any era, has got to do with their mental aptitude and their ability to absorb disappointment and to be able to stand up and come each day and that will to win.
In 2009, you were appointed coach of the Australian Davis Cup team. How does a player develop their style? What difference can a coach make?
Well, you ask about the style. The court surface that you are brought up in has a lot to do with that. Mm. So I was brought up in Australia. Grass was still played on a little bit. We played a lot on synthetic grass, had just come in. Now, that's a surface that is only an offensive surface. You cannot be defensive and learn defense. So my game style was produced around that. I came forward, I hit the ball flat to be able to win points. Now, the Europeans are on clay. They have to be aggressive to win points, but they also know that they can move back a little bit, shape the ball higher, and keep themselves in a rally a little longer. So you learn to be offensive and defensive. That is now how we're coaching our players in Australia. So the traditional serve volley and aggressive nature of Australian tennis has slowly become a more neutralized, homogenized game that the whole world is playing the same way. And in some ways, it's better for our kids. Obviously, that we need them to be that to compete internationally, but we've lost a little bit of the element that was the Australian way of playing. But, of course, we don't have a lot of grass court tournaments anymore. Melbourne Park being on plexi cushion is what our kids long to perform well on, so they've got to be trained to play on that. So coaching is hugely important, but your game develops around what surface you play on, and then it also develops around what style of play you've grown up watching. So a lot of this generation have watched Nadal and Federer and Djokovic, so they emulate that. What I'm loving at the moment is this next generation who's just come through that are trying to beat those. On the men's side is Stefanos Tsitsipas from Greece. He's playing a beautiful style of tennis where he's being aggressive and using the net. It's a throwback style. And of course, Ash Barty is an all-court player who is starting to unravel the big hitters that just sit on the baseline and slam because she's got a lovely slice backhand. She can draw her opponent forward. So tactically, the generation is starting to change again, and we see that cyclical style happen throughout tennis.
There is a culture that's developed in sport, the winning at all cost culture. We've seen it in Australian cricket in particular, and we notice it with some of the tantrums on the court. Is there a detrimental culture that should be dealt with in high-level sport?
I think a lot of this has come about because of our phones, because of social media.
Extra pressure.
A huge amount of extra pressure. Every single moment of a sports person's life, or anybody's life nowadays, is basically documented. When I was coming along, I mentioned my temperament not great. Now, if I was playing out on court two at whatever tournament I was, we really didn't even have cameras out there. It wasn't on television. Now every court's live streamed. If I made a mistake and bounced a racket, it didn't make it to the news. Now it does. And so there is extra pressure, extra focus. That's not an excuse, but it is actual fact. And so everybody is under the microscope far more than they ever have been before. So, you know, that's what technology has brought to sport. And that isn't an excuse, though, for, you know, behaviours. And that's what Ash Barty has been brought back. And the whole world is talking about her, the way that she's handled winning a French, her reactions weren't over the top, the way she dealt with the media, the way her behaviour was on court. But I will say she's come from a really good family and they have taught her well. And if you knew her mum, Josie, and dad, Rob, well, none of it would surprise you with how Ash behaves.
Yeah. And top performers are role models. And that's the other thing about social media and the exposure, I suppose, that they are actually role models for young, not just young players, but young people in general.
Yeah, and that's a hard thing for a young athlete to actually understand, because you're in it for yourself and it's your bubble. And I talked to you about the depressive factors that you have if you're not succeeding. You really don't care what other people think. You're self-absorbed. But in reality, you must understand that is the case, that a young person is watching you, maybe wanting to be like you and emulate you. And look, I think in my sport, we are absolutely blessed to have two of the greatest ambassadors that have ever played any sport, and that's Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, two very different characters, different styles of individuals. One is the classic James Bond being Federer, and then you've got, you know, a real gritty, bullish Rafael Nadal, but both as humans bring that quality that people can attract themselves to and say, I want to be like that.
Todd, it's time for our next piece of music, and you've chosen an instrumental piece, An American in Paris, and it's from the original Broadway cast recording of the musical.
Yeah, well, I saw this a couple of seasons ago in London. And I was fascinated by it. The music is beautiful. The orchestra was magnificent. And it was some of the very best dancing that I've ever seen in music theatre. The contemporary ballet with Robert Fairchild and Leanne Cope. It is available to watch the full show on streaming now. And if you get the opportunity, it is brilliant.
Thank you.
music from An American in Paris, and that was from the original Broadway cast recording. Thanks very much, Todd Woodbridge. That was a wonderful piece. Thank you. You married your wife, Natasha, nearly 25 years ago, and you're in peak career, and you've got two children, Zara and Beau. Was there a cost in terms of the time that you're able to spend with them in those early years?
No, fortunately. I was quite adamant that when the kids came along, that if I was away on tour for more than 2 weeks, that they would then have to come and join me or I would go home. And that was sort of our rule of thumb, and we managed to do that pretty well. But I finished playing professionally when the kids, Zara was 4 and Beau was 2. And we decided to move from Orlando in Florida, where we lived, and bring the kids back here and get them ready to start school here, because we wanted them to have an education in Australia, which has been the right thing to do. We're very happy that we made that call.
What would you like for them? Would you have encouraged them to be elite achievers in some field as you were?
Look, I think they will both tell you, particularly our daughter, who's 18 now, Zara. She was a fine golfer coming through and was had played at state level in the junior team and then in the women's team as well. So, and she played a couple of British amateur championships as well as a teenager, and then found it difficult, went through a patch that has been a little troublesome for her, and she's on the other side of that now. But she said now it's actually harder to be associated with somebody like myself because you've been successful, and she felt a bit of that pressure. Mm. So the great thing is she's been honest about it and opened up, and so because of that now she's starting to move on into her own things, of what she feels she needs and wants to do. But my son Beau's the same in a sense, but he's been successful in his own right. And as a parent, my goal was to show them what's out there, what's available, tell them about the things I did that were successful and the things I did that weren't, so that they don't see everything I did as being something extraordinary. But I wanted them to see the world, and they've been lucky enough to do that. I wanted to see what's on offer and to choose something in their life that, even at times when you don't like it, you actually appreciate it, and it's not something you have to do. And I've been blessed with that opportunity with sport. Beau with music and theatre and drama is finding that as well. You'd think as a 9-year-old, his first show was on stage for 2 years in 4 productions, including Mary Poppins, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Love Never Dies. He knows what he wants to do, and he's visited the world, seen the places that he wants to work, and that's what he's working towards. And, you know, I'm lucky because he's had that opportunity, and so have I.
Well, they're both very lucky to have the kind of support that you're offering, and also to both have identified fields at this stage anyway,
yeah,
that really do press their buttons.
I probably was guilty, and my wife, Natasha, guilty too, of where we actually tried to steer them a little bit away from tennis, because I don't think it would have been great for them to be involved in that. But mind you, Beau, as an 8-year-old, was sitting in the car next to his mother one day, and he turned to her and said, "Mum, I don't want to play tennis." And she says, "Well, that's all right." He says, "Good, because that's Dad's thing."
Yeah.
So he knew.
That says it all.
He had good intuition.
You've become a tennis commentator, which is a very different role to actually being a player. But has being a top player been important for you in doing that commentating?
Very much. I think in commentary, to have people believe you, you have to have been there, because you can talk from your experiences, and I just mentioned from your successes but also your failures, to understand what it feels like to get nervous serving for a match, what emotions are running through you at certain parts, whether it be the walkout, whether it be serving for a set, or whether it be a first big victory over a top 10 player. They're all the things that as a commentator you have to express and get the viewer at home to understand. At the same time, as a commentator, one of my goals is to work out and tell the viewer the how and why. It's not the obvious. It's how did they do it and why did they do that? And if I can get that across, then I know that the viewer is actually learning something, and they're watching a match from a very different perspective. And that's what I've enjoyed about the crossover into that field.
Yeah, you've done other things recently too. I mean, you're president of the Australian Davis Cup Tennis Foundation, and you've also been an ambassador for bowel cancer awareness.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk about those and what they involve?
Absolutely. Well, the Davis Cup Foundation is a new role for me, just really a few weeks old, in fact, because Neil Fraser, who has been the president since its inception, has asked me to take that on, and I couldn't say no to him because too much respect. We talk about generations. So Davis Cup is changing in the tennis landscape. We don't know where and what that may look like as we move forward, but we have a group of supporters that love it, and I'll do my best to continue to provide opportunity for tennis fans in that sense. But two charities that I've had a lot to do with, you mentioned that. I was on the board of Challenge, that looks after kids with cancer in Victoria, for 7 years. That was a very important part, and it touched my other love, which has been golf, with Jared Lyle. He was a young man that came through that and recently passed away, made a professional golf career. So that was one of those. The other you mentioned was the Bowel Cancer Foundation, yes, with Cabrini in Melbourne, and also did another campaign with a national ad during the Australian Open about awareness of those things. So I'm lucky that I'm in a position where I can actually help those, A, to raise money, but B, to raise awareness. And a lot of times it's just about the awareness, that people know that they've got support or opportunity to make sure that they look after their health. My sport is very big on health because we're a game that can be played from whether it be 8 to 80. And being active, being healthy is part of, you know, a healthy lifestyle and living longer. And tennis drives that. And I've got the opportunity of having to work with both of those organisations, which has been brilliant.
We've come full circle now. We're going back to Love Never Dies, which is obviously a very favourite musical, Todd.
Yes, but I've chosen this song with Anna O'Byrne, and the song is Love Never Dies, but I chose it because I wanted to keep an Australian theme of artists and people that have internationally made their name. And Anna has gone on to brilliant things, playing Christine and Phantom in London. Recently was back in My Fair Lady in Melbourne, and she's a beautiful voice, a lovely lady, and having an exceptional career, and I wanted to showcase that.
Love never falters. submit, surrender flesh and bone. That love takes on a life far greater than your own. It uses you at whim and drives you to despair and forces you to feel more joy than you can bear. Love gives you pleasure and love brings you pain. And yet when both are gone, love will still.
Anna O'Byrne singing Love Never Dies by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Thanks, Todd Woodbridge, for that selection as well and for that choice of singer. She's really lovely and only 31.
Yeah, and as I say, the reason I've showcased three Australian singers today is A, I've met them, I know them, you know, I could call them friends, but they've all internationally made names for themselves and you know, I like to showcase music theatre because I think it's so difficult. I think it's so tough. It's exactly like sport, whether it be you have to sing, dance and act, the work that gets put in. I don't think people really understand the depth of time it takes to become so good.
Well, now I would like to go full circle and go back to Todd, the young boy. Let's go back, you know, 40 years. And if you were to write a letter to your younger self, I wonder what you'd say in it.
I would say don't change anything. Put yourself on the same journey, but don't be so hard on yourself. Realise that there are moments that you don't need to pressure yourself so extraordinarily hard and let things happen. Open up and let things happen because they will if you're prepared and you've put yourself in that right place. The door will open, and as long as you have done your work, you can be ready to walk through. But if I had any time to reflect, there were moments in my career where I pushed myself too hard and I didn't get the results because of the pressure that I'd put myself under.
And they sound like lessons that you've been passing on to your son and daughter.
I've tried to do that, yeah. And then I guess, as we all know, as you get older, your experiences create who you are, and you've got to have them as well.
Yeah.
So you can't skip any of those moments in your life. You have to go through the ups and the downs, and it makes you stronger. If you're a songwriter, that's what you learn. That's where you get your depth, and that's where you get your lyrics from, isn't it? But I know that was really important. There was a probably last touching story. A key moment for me was two deaths. One was the death of Renee Appleby, the golfer Stuart Appleby's wife, in 1997. We're exactly the same age, Stuart, myself, and our two wives. She was killed in an accident at Waterloo Station. And when that happened, I thought we were invincible as young people. You thought nothing can stop us. And a life was taken away where I've gone, oh, that could have been Natasha, it could have been me. We became, you know, still friends for Stuart and still are. And then 18 months later, Payne Stewart, the American golfer, was killed in a plane crash when his plane decompressed and it flew across the country and crashed. Now, Payne was the first person on my doorstep, our doorstep in Orlando, when Stuart rang to say that Renee had been killed in London that morning, because he knew as young Australians away from home, we needed to have somebody to talk to. It was at 7 a.m. he got on my door. And 18 months later, as another dear friend, he was gone. From that moment on, my career, I probably didn't play as well in singles because I decided to say to myself, you don't need to be that intense anymore. Yeah. You need to learn to live your life and enjoy it. And, you know, in singles, you know, I was top 20 in the world. I got to semifinal at Wimbledon, but it did change the way I performed on the court because I lost what I'd call that white line fever that sometimes you need to have as a competitor.
Well, Todd, just in finishing, thank you very much for those reflections. They were wonderful. And you're on your way to Wimbledon. Mm. Will we have a chance to see you on our TV sets?
I'll hope that you'll be able to hear me on the coverage. I'm doing some work for BBC, so some of that feed will come back to Australia. And I'll be playing the Legends of Enham, the defending champion with Jonas Bjorkman in the over 45s Invitational. So hoping to bring back some more silverware as well. But I better get to the practice court after this interview if that's going to happen.
Fabulous. Well, thank you very much to Todd Woodbridge. It's been a great pleasure and a huge delight to have you come to 3MBS today.
My pleasure, thank you.
And my thanks also to our technical producer, Stuart McMillan, and our executive producer, Nikki Gilderdale. I'm Doug Beecroft.